is brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
I think the common denominator in college is a majority of the time in recruiting, you've got to get to know the parents. And you can choose if you want that parent in your program or not in recruiting, right? And I think that there's some parents that are so overbearing and so much that there's some coaches that say, I don't want that in my program. I don't like where that's going to lead.
Pete Gash is entering his first season as a men's basketball assistant coach at the University of Maine. Gash joined the Black Bears with 15 years of Division I experience at six different institutions, including stops at Florida Atlantic, the University of Florida, the University of Tennessee Chattanooga, UMass, LaSalle University, and Wagner. Gash began his coaching career in 2007 as the video coordinator at LaSalle for former University of Maine head coach, Dr. John Giannini. Gash, a native of Long Island, New York, earned a Bachelor of Arts degree in Hospitality Administration with a specialization in sports management from Lynn University in 2006. Hey, Hoopheads, sign up today for the Summer of Better virtual basketball camp with our partners and friends at Dr. Dish Basketball. Their Dr. Dish shooting machines are undoubtedly the most advanced and user-friendly machines on the market. And remember, you can get up to $2,000 off on any trade-in. Learn more at drdishbasketball.com and follow their incredible content at Dr. Dish B-Ball on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. Mention the Hoopheads podcast and save an extra $300 on the Dr. Dish Rebel, All-Star, and CT models. Visit drdishbasketball.com for details. That's a great deal, Hoopheads. Get your Dr. Dish shooting machine today.
Hi, this is TK Griffith, boys head varsity basketball coach at Archbishop Hope in High School, and you're listening to the Hoopheads podcast.
If you're looking to improve your coaching, please consider joining the Hoopheads mentorship program. We believe that having a mentor is the best way to maximize your potential and become a transformational coach. By matching you up with one of our experienced mentors, you'll develop a one-on-one relationship that will help your coaching, your team, your program, and your mindset. The Hoopheads Mentorship Program delivers mentoring services to basketball coaches at all levels through our team of experienced head coaches. Find out more at hoopheadspod.com or shoot me an email directly, mike@hoopheadspod.com. Follow us on social media at hoopheadspod on Twitter and Instagram, and be sure to check out the Hoopheads Podcast Network for more great basketball content. Prepare like the pros with the all-new Fast Draw and Fast Scout. Fast Draw has been the number one play diagramming software for coaches for years. You'll quickly see why Fast Model Sports has the most compelling and intuitive basketball software out there. For a limited time, Fast Model is offering Hoopheads listeners 15% off Fast Draw and Fast Scout. Just use the code HHP15 at checkout to grab your discount, and you'll be on your way to more efficient game prep and improved communication with your team. Fast Model also has new coaching content every week on its blog, plus play and drill diagrams on its playbank. Check out the links in the show notes for more. Fast Model Sports is the best in basketball. Be prepared to take some notes as you listen to this episode with Pete Gash, men's basketball assistant coach at the University of Maine. Hello and welcome to the Hoopheads podcast. It's Mike Klinzing here with my co-host Jason Sunkel tonight. And we are pleased to welcome from the University of Maine, men's basketball assistant coach, Pete Gash. Pete, welcome to the Hoopheads pod.
Hey, man. Thanks for having me, guys.
Absolutely. Excited to have you on. Want to dive into the things that you've been able to do thus far in your career. And then we're going to spend a bulk of our time tonight in the podcast talking about the University of Maine and what you guys are trying to build up there with the basketball program. So let's start by going back in time. Tell us a little bit about how you got in the game of basketball as a kid.
Yeah. So, basketball in my family has always been very, very important. So my dad went to the University of North Carolina and didn't play, but was a big fan. You know, he grew up in the state of North Carolina and he really got me into basketball at a really young age. And when I was younger, I didn't really realize the significance of all the guys that he was talking about when I was younger, until I really got into the history of the game. But one of the things that he did was he had this infatuation with Michael Jordan, because Michael Jordan was obviously a North Carolina grad. So, you know, 3-4 years old in Long Island, being a Bulls fan was kind of weird on the outside looking in the 90s, right? So everyone was all about the Knicks, and we were diehard Bulls fans because of Michael Jordan. But I got in that way, ended up moving to Bucks County, Pennsylvania, where I went to the Solbury Prep School. And I went there at the time when they were in the top 25 in the country. And I really just got into this higher level of basketball and realized pretty early in my high school career that I wasn't as good as the 7 or 8 Division I players that we had that I was playing with and competing with every day. So really just tried to figure out a way to be around the game as much as possible and kind of stay around a team atmosphere. That's what led me to coaching. But it was those young days of my dad taking me to Long Island Lutheran games in Long Island, and then going to see Kobe Bryant play when we moved up to Bucks County in high school, and going to the old Primetime Shootout in New Jersey and watching Shaheen Holloway and Al Harrington and Bobby Hurley coach at St. Anthony's, and got a chance to watch him. And that's kind of where it all got started. And then just kind of wanted to be around it moving forward with my life, and realized there weren't a lot of 6'2" power forwards in Division I, and had to kind of find a way to stick around the game.
You had a chance. You played with Andrew Bynum, correct?
Yeah, I did. I had 2 years with Andrew. He came to us as a freshman when I was a junior at Solbury School. He was a 6'11" freshman. His feet were size 18. Couldn't make a jump hook, couldn't get up and down the floor, but you could tell there was something there because he just looked so young and was just starting to figure it out.
Half court shots across the gym when he wasn't happy at practice.
Actually Bynum wouldn't show up when he didn't want to practice. So it was, we didn't get a lot of bad moods. We just got like, oh, where is he today? That was kind of the mode he was in as a 15-14 year old kid.
So as you're starting to put together this plan of, hey, I want to be a coach, I want to stay involved in the game, and I want to do it through coaching, did you have somebody that you reached out to, that you talked to, that kind of served as, I don't know if mentor is the right word, but just somebody who maybe gave you some early guidance in your coaching career, or kind of pointed you in the right direction of, hey, here's what you should think about doing, or here's who you should talk to as you're trying to get into the coaching profession?
Yeah, there was two things that kind of happened. The first thing that happened was my mom, who is Italian and from Brooklyn, you know, born in Italy, but from Brooklyn, she kept on kind of nudging me about Calipari and Rick Pitino. And I didn't really get what she was doing in high school. But now looking back on it, she kind of saw the writing on the wall that my playing days were going to be numbered. And she said, look at these two Italian coaches. So this is something you might want to get into if you love basketball this much. So that was one way. But really what happened was when I started looking at where I was going to go to school, I was going to go walk on at a couple different Division II places. And I was going to go play some Division III basketball in the state of New Jersey. And then what happened was I ended up getting accepted into Lynn University in Boca Raton, Florida. And they had a young coach who was 28 years old at the time. His name was Scott McMillan. I went down there on a visit. He said, come walk on. You know, you have an opportunity to make the team. He was like, but, you know, you're telling me about coaching, like we might have something here for you if it doesn't work out. So my first week at Lynn, you know, I'm training, I'm getting in shape, I'm playing, and I end up hurting myself pretty bad in like one of our first couple like workout individual type situation. And he looked at me and was like, hey, I have one graduate assistant in me. He was like, if you want to do this, we'll make you a student assistant. You'll kind of grow up in coaching. I'll let you get your hands, you know, dirty with scouting and recruiting. And back then you could go live scouting and see if you like it. So I did it. I fell in love with it. I started getting in the gym with guys. I kind of made it my own little thing. And that's kind of really the person that gave me allowed the light bulb to go off for me that coaching made more sense than trying to figure it out and play when I was in college.
Would you say that initially from a coaching standpoint, that player development piece and working with guys in the gym on the floor, because you were a player, you probably still at that point kind of thought of yourself as a player. Was that the first part of coaching that you really fell in love with? Was that player development side of it?
Yeah. So it's really interesting you say that. So my roommate was a 6'8" Danish kid named Hans Shore, who was a walk-on. So we both were kind of there as walk-ons. Right. And I ended up doing the coaching thing. He ended up becoming a really good player, a 4-year starter. But what happened was, when I was kind of thrusted into this role of like, okay, I need you more to help me coach than I do to help me play, I started going to the gym with him at night and just working on jump hooks and working on his mid-range game and taking him out to three and just passing with him and working with him. And I'm on the bench like 4 games into the season. He hasn't gotten off the bench yet. He checks into the game, and I swear, like, my heart rate went up, my nerves went up, I was sweating, I was all worked up. And I started like almost having that feeling of like, your brother or your son or your child is out there, right? And he went out there, he made a jump hook, he walled up on defense, he really impacted the game. And I remember never experiencing a feeling like that while playing, like that just pure excitement and happiness for someone else to succeed. And I was like, man, this is what it feels like. This is what coaching feels like. And then that's kind of where it took off. So yeah, the player development piece, but I think also just combining like serving other people, being a good teammate, and player development all wrapped in one. And that was kind of where I was like, all right, I got the itch now to really get into this coaching thing.
Was there something about coaching when you transitioned from playing to coaching? Was there some aspect of coaching as you got into it in that first year that you're like, man, I didn't realize coaches spent so much time doing this, or man, as a player, this piece of coaching was kind of invisible to me. Is there anything that you can think of that sort of fits that description?
Yeah. So very easy. So I'm in my first workout, and one of the guys takes the charges and flies on the floor, and he just left all this sweat. And the head coach, Scott McMillan, looks at me. He's like, wipe it up. And I'm like, right in that moment, I'm like, all my pride, all my ego, everything flies out the window, and I'm on all fours wiping up a wet spot. And like in the middle of doing it, I'm like, what am I doing? But then you get up, and like the next play, you're trying to help someone close out, or you're trying to move the drill fast. And you're like, you don't even have time to think about your ego or yourself when you're coaching. If you're really into it, you don't have time for that. And that was one of those things where I hope I'm answering your question the right way, but like when you're a player, you're worried a lot about how you're doing. And when you're a coach, you're really worried about how the team's doing. So it was like one of those things that just kind of hit me, and it kind of made a lot of sense and takes a lot of pressure off you when you kind of give up your ego and you're kind of all in it to see the kids succeed and see your team succeed.
Absolutely. I think there's a different focus as a player. Obviously, you're concerned about the success of your team as well, but so much of what you spend your time on as a player is trying to get better, trying to have an impact on the team, trying to see how you fit into the team's success. And as a player, as a coach, that mentality completely shifts to where you're no longer worried about one individual's role or one individual, how they're going to do. You're worried about how that all those individuals fit together to create a team. And again, it's a totally, totally different dynamic and a totally different way of thinking about it. And it's interesting that you're one of the few people that I've talked to that has said that the feeling, it's almost like the feeling you got from coaching was you love that feeling almost more than you love the feeling that you got as a player. Is that right?
Yeah. Well, when you're not very good, you're not making 6 threes in a game or hitting a late game big shot, and you don't get, I always felt like in basketball, I was swimming out there. Like, yeah. I played really hard. I tried really hard, but I just couldn't do certain things on the court. You know what I mean? And, yep. And I had a couple really good games against Long Island Lutheran. We were at Solbury, and against Hun Hill when we were playing against Maple League teams. But like, I just never was the guy. I was always around really, really good players from AAU to high school. So I never really got that state of, you know, this is all about me. I always was kind of just trying to make it work as a player. And I think that's one of the reasons why it was easier for me to accept that role in coaching And, you know, I did. I got more of that euphoric coaching high than I did, you know, as a player. There's no doubt about that. And to be honest with you, Mike, like, I'm really glad that I put that together early in college, because there's a lot of kids that go to college and they're fighting this battle of just trying to almost like be cool and be on the team and just be the one that gets the suit up and wear a jersey. I got a 3-year head start on getting to the Division I level because I was in Orlando at AAU Nationals taking notes on, you know, every high school kid in the state of Florida and Georgia. And and that was all because I kind of slowly realized that coaching was more of what I was yearning for than just trying to feel cool or be on a college team. I think if more people realize that, they would figure out that coaching is what they want to do, and their transition would be a lot easier into being a professional.
That's interesting. We just talked to our first interview tonight was with Brian Ansberry, who's a head high school coach here in the Cleveland area. And he was talking about just sort of his path to coaching. And he was a kid who played at a really good high school program in Cleveland. And he had to decide whether he wanted to play Division III or whether he was going to go to a bigger school. He ended up going to Ohio U and trying to walk on and never made the team. And he's like, man, if I would have known sort of more about what the path to coaching was all about, he goes, what I should have done is just been a student assistant. I should have been a manager, and that would have been a great route for me to sort of, again, go behind the scenes and be a part of the coaching staff and get to sit in on some of those meetings and be involved and build relationships with those coaches. He's like, but I just didn't realize this is in 2001. He's like, I just didn't realize that was a potential path. And then I told him, yeah, I go, when I was playing, so that was a long, long, long time ago, 88 to 92. Like, I never looked at the guys who were managers. I never thought, oh, those are guys who potentially want to get coaching jobs. I was like, oh, they must just want to hang around with the players and just, you know, be a part of the team. And now you look at the number of guys, whether it's at the high school level or certainly at the college level, the number of guys who come through that student assistant / manager role and end up going to and getting really good jobs because of the relationships they've been able to build and the knowledge that they're able to gain. And I think what you described is what I see way more guys going that path, and also understanding that that's a very viable path to get into the profession.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So there's two things, Mike, about that are really interesting. So the first thing is it kind of all goes back to like self-awareness, which is one of the gifts that you hope your players and your staff and people that you work with have is just being aware of yourself, you know? And I think the earlier that we can all do that, the easier it'll be for everyone to really make a successful coaching career. And that doesn't mean that you can't chase things. And that doesn't mean that you can't set your goals high and really want to make a Division I team or whatever. Like, that's not what it is, but there is a certain level of self-awareness that can really help you in any profession. You know, in coaching for me, it's one of those things where anytime I've been on staff with a really good guard in college. So right now we got a guy on our staff, Jordan Bronner, who played at New Hampshire, who's a point guard. Like, I'm not going to go in there and be like, hey, let me take the guards. I've worked with all these guards my whole career. Like, no, like, you played guard at the Division I level. You've done it, handle that. That's you. I have a very good self-awareness. You know, I've always been on staff with really good players. So a lot of them were guards. So it was like, hey, I got to find a way to be really good with front court guys and really good with X and O's and really bring value in other ways, because I didn't really have the background knowledge of, hey, I went out there and split pick and rolls in a college game. I could teach it and I could study it. But if they want someone that has done it, then they're probably going to look for a former player. So it kind of goes back to just being aware of yourself and what you can bring to a staff. And then the second part to what you talked about is a couple of years ago, there was a Final Four. I'm trying to remember who was in it, but it was a really interesting Final Four. I think three of the four guys in the Final Four that coached were either student managers or like Division III players, maybe. I'm trying to think of who it was. Might have been like Mark Few, Coach Drew at Baylor, Sampson, and I'm thinking about who was the fourth guy in that Final Four. And I think the National Coach of the Year that year was Juwan Howard, right? So I would always look at that as a way of, you could be an NBA top 5 pick, and be a really good coach like Juwan Howard, or you could be starting out wiping wet spots and rebounding for guys like Coach Drew at Baylor and win a national championship. So there's really, coaching is like a universal language. And, you know, people try to put you in a box a lot of times, but if you're really aware of yourself and you know what you can do and you're valuable in what you can do, it doesn't matter if you made a three in college, you didn't play college basketball, or you were a Hall of Famer. You can coach, you can coach.
Right. You can teach it, right? You got to be able to teach the game. And I think that's one of the things that if you are a former player, that is really hard. I know I can speak from my own experiences that as a former player, my first year or two of coaching, I was terrible because the only thing I knew was what I knew as a player. The only two coaches that I had ever been around were my high school coach and my college coach. So everything that I knew about basketball, which I thought at the time as a 23-year-old guy was, you know, I thought I knew pretty much everything, right? I kind of had this ego of like, hey man, I was a good player. I'm sure I'm going to be a good coach, but you look back on it, you're like, I didn't study the game. I didn't do some of the things that you were describing that you did in order to improve your craft. I was more the guy who's like, hey, I could play. So now suddenly I can coach. And I think you make a great point that ultimately what it comes down to is players want to trust that you can make them better. And if a coach, a head coach is going to hire you onto their staff, that head coach wants to know that you can make the players better, that ultimately you can make the team better. And I don't think at this point, I don't think it really matters what your background is. If you're willing to put in the time and learn, and then you can teach the game, there's a place for, as you said, anybody. It doesn't matter if you were an NBA player or you were a guy who got cut from your high school team. If you're invested in what you're doing and you're learning your craft, there's certainly a way that you can have a very, very outstanding and successful career as a coach. There's no doubt about that in my mind.
Yeah. Yeah. No, you're 100% right. I really hope that every young coach that's trying to get into it that didn't play, I really hope that they understand that, you know, when everyone wants to tell their war stories about when they were younger as coaches, but it was a lot harder to do it, you know, 10, 15 years ago and get in than it is now. And be very appreciative of whatever role you have. And, you know, don't be a guy that's just in it because you want to post it on social media. Be a guy that's in it because, you know, you want to learn how to help a program win and just kind of be a star in whatever role you can do, or get really good at video, or get really good at recruiting graphics, or get really good at being on the court and being in player development. Just like really be good in your role, and don't just do it to feel like you're supposed to be doing it, but do it because you want to serve and you want to be a good coach.
Absolutely. All right. So you've served as an assistant coach under a variety of head coaches at the Division I level and at a number of different schools. So what I want to do so that we can make sure that we get an opportunity to dive in deep with what you guys are building there at Maine, let's just talk about in general at your stops along the way before you get to the University of Maine. What are some of the big lessons that you've learned along the way as an assistant coach that you've brought into your experience that you're having at Maine so far? Let's kind of approach it that way.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I've worked for, I think 8 or 9 different Division I or II head coaches, one Division II head coach. I think 8 Division I head coaches. And I've gotten so much from all of them. You know, one of the biggest things that I've been able to do, with working with all these guys is really take a lot of notes on how they responded to different things. So when I worked for Coach Donovan, which was in those 8-9 months that I worked for him, I felt like that's where I learned the most about running a program, dealing with players. I just remember taking a lot of notes on like how he was after losses, how he was after a day off, how he was on a Saturday morning individual at 9 a.m. I just really took a lot of notes on how he approached it. So with all those different guys, I really learned how they approached kind of the daily routine. And, you know, it's been really good for me because the last couple guys that I've worked for in Ashley Howard and Bastian Mason, they're kind of cut from the same cloth, just this tough, defensive minded, no excuses mentality. Right. And I always wanted to kind of marry that with Tom Crean's player development and Coach Donovan's offensive system. Right. John Giannini's ability to run a program. And I kind of taken a little bit of all those guys and kind of morphed together And I'm just trying to marry it for whenever I get an opportunity to hopefully be a head coach one day. But more importantly, I want to bring whatever I've learned from those guys to whoever I'm working for now. Right. And I think whenever you get a chance to work for a lot of different head coaches, you've got to really look at what they do really well and take that with you and kind of almost have it in like this mental folder where now when you're having a discussion, you could bring up and there's some credibility to it. You know, there's some credibility to, hey, when I was at LaSalle with Coach Giannini, here's how we handled our sit out guys. Or here's when I worked for Coach Donovan, guys 8 through 13 on the roster, here's how we managed them during the year. Or Tom Green, this is how we did individuals and how we blended individuals with practice. So guys were always getting better. Just like those little parts of it from all of those guys that you can take and kind of put in your folder. And then now when you have conversations with the guy that you're working for, you can give him as many suggestions as he wants. And then he can pick and choose whichever one he thinks fits the program. So that's kind of the benefit of all these different head coaches that I've worked for. And, you know, it's not been great on my moving expenses every single time I've gotten a job, but it's been really good for me in terms of getting to see a lot of different head coaches and kind of how they do things and how they operate.
Let's talk about the opportunity at the University of Maine. So Coach Markwood gets the job in March of this year. You come on in May. Talk a little bit about the process, how you become aware of the opening, what were the relationships that brought you to the University of Maine, and then what was, just talk a little bit about the interview process and why you felt like this was a good fit for your next move.
Yeah, so I've known Coach Markwood for about 3 or 4 years now. You know, when I was an assistant at UMass, he was at Northeastern, and we kind of recruited similar guys in the New England area. But we also kind of dabbled into some pockets that Northeastern was recruiting into, you know, whether it was Florida or Minnesota, they were recruiting those areas. And we kind of always were trying to go outside the box a little bit at UMass and find guys outside of the region. And it was always like, hey, Northeastern's recruiting this guy, or you'd be in Minnesota and Northeastern has a kid that played at this high school the year before. And, you know, there was just always kind of this common ground. And then it's actually a funny story. We were at an MTE when I was at LaSalle in the Gulf Coast Classic down in Florida. And I'm in the lobby, and someone is talking about the state of Maine behind me. And I'm like, yeah, you know, Maine's a great state. I'm like, you know, my old boss, you know, used to be the head coach at Maine. And they, and this woman says, well, you know, my son-in-law played at Maine. I said, really? And she said, yeah, Chris Markwood. And then Chris Markwood's wife was there. My wife was there, and we're all talking. And I'm like, you know, Coach Giannini gave me my first job at you know, at the Division I level, you know, at LaSalle. And I had no idea that Chris worked or played for Coach G. And I had no idea. So we kind of all just sat there and talked a little bit. And Chris came down and we kind of connected some dots. And then we just kind of kept talking over the last couple of years. And when he had an opportunity to get the main job, Coach Giannini called me and he said, you know, if you have an opportunity to go work for Chris Markwood, you need to drop what you're doing and go. And when Coach Giannini speaks, I listen. He is my basketball dad, right? Like anything that he says, I normally do because he's so smart. He knows me. And he said, you and Chris would be great. He said, he's going to get it rolling up there. Maine's a great place. No one knows about how good of a place it is. I'm telling you, go do it. So I interviewed with Chris, and in the process of interviewing with Chris, Bashir Mason got the St. Peter's job. And I was really down the road with Chris. And Chris called me and he offered me the job. And that morning, Bosh took the St. Peter's job. So I told Bosh, I love you. I'm so happy for you. I gave him a big hug. We took him out. I said, I've been down the road with Chris. I want to do this. It's going to be great for my family. And I took the job, and then Coach went to St. Peter's and I came up here to Maine, and it's been one of the best experiences and decisions I could have ever made to come up here, just because of what type of person Chris Markwood is and what type of environment that he's building. Like if you could, as a coach, if you could paint what you want in terms of family values, player development, spending time with the guys, everyone's included, well thought out. If you could paint that picture, that's kind of what Chris is as a coach and as a and as a leader. And it's been really refreshing, and it's been really great for me to get up here and bring my family up here to the University of Maine.
In some of those first conversations that you had with Chris, what were some of the talking points that you and he went through when you start thinking about what it was going to take to get the program where he wanted it to go? What was the vision that he talked about with you that made you think beyond your personal relationship with him? What was the vision for the University of Maine? What were the things that he was telling you he saw, or things that you saw in the program that made you think, hey, we can build the kind of program that we can be proud of up here?
Yeah. Well, you know, the first thing that we talked about was just like the appreciation for being at Maine. Like, he wanted people that have an appreciation for being at Maine, right? So since Ted Woodward had a team that won 19 games, that might have been in 2008, 2009, I'm not sure, but they haven't had a double-digit win season in over 10 years. So he knew that the success had not been there in a while, but he wanted guys that were going to come up there, embrace the job, had an appreciation for being a basketball coach at the University of Maine, and knew that, okay, there were going to be some hurdles, but like, how were we going to jump over those hurdles and make it work? And I kind of felt that from him. Like, he had this kind of attitude about him where, I played here, I'm from the state, I know we can be good. I was on teams when we were good. I coached on teams when we were good at Maine. I know what this thing looks like. I want a staff that's going to be appreciative of being up here and kind of being it with me. And that kind of sold me, because my whole opportunity in basketball, I've tried to be really thankful and grateful from where I am, right? And I was like, that's exactly the environment that I want. And that's kind of where it started. And then I kind of listened to him talk about how he wanted to build it and kind of what he took from Coach Cohen at Northeastern and Coach Grant at Boston College and Coach Becker at Vermont. And I'm listening to him talk, and I'm like, if there's one guy that can get this program where it needs to go, it's Chris. And that's what I was like, okay, this is a no-brainer. I got to get up here and I got to make this work, and I got to serve him and get this program to look the way that he wants it to look.
What was the first thing that he put on your plate after he hired you?
The first thing he told me was, my wife was due in like 3 weeks, and he was like, hey, don't come up here until until that baby's out and healthy.
Good advice there, right?
Yeah. I've worked for some guys that said, you know, are you on your way up yet? And I'm like, let me get settled here. So it was really refreshing when he told me that, to worry about my family first. That made everyone, you know, really, really excited in the Gash household. That was the first thing. But, you know, he really just wanted me to get an understanding of the roster. And then he just kind of talked to me about what he wanted in terms of IQ and guys that had a feel for the game. And you know, he really valued shooting, and just kind of started having me put together a list of available players that we can get involved with. And we kind of hopped on some Zooms and some calls, and I was at home, and he kind of let me stay there until we all got settled, and then I headed north.
When you guys thought about where the program was and you look at where you wanted to go, you mentioned that there might be potentially some hurdles that you're going to have to get over. What were some of the things that you guys talked about internally when you looked at where the program was when Chris took over, and then when you come on board? What were some of the things that you felt like you had to overcome, for lack of a better way of saying it?
Yes. So it's really interesting, because everyone kind of went, when I took the job, they kind of looked at me like, oh, Maine, like, you know, why are you going up there? You know, what do you think up there? And I kind of like looked at everyone, and I was like, well, what's not to like, right? It's a state university. You got a beautiful campus. You're in a city of Bangor. You're an hour away from Bar Harbor, which is one of the most beautiful beaches in the country. And everyone keeps talking about the cold in the winter, and it gets so cold up there in November. And I just look at it as like the biggest hurdle that we have to overcome is just kind of the perception and the initial shock. Like the initial shock of, oh, Maine's recruiting me. That's a little bit further away than maybe I thought I was going to go to school. Right. And then just the perception of that that Maine hasn't been good in about a decade. And I think once we can get over those two things, I think the floodgates are really going to open up. And what I've noticed so far since being up here is if people are telling you that it's cold and that's the only reason that they can come up with for why not to want to go to school at the University of Maine, then they're not really serious minded and they're not really people that we want in our program, right? And if coaches are using that against you, then that's a pretty shallow way of recruiting against us. So that's kind of like how I've kind of gone about this thing where, again, it goes back to being appreciative of the opportunity and the university and just looking at it from the standpoint of, okay, we know there's a hurdle. You got to get up here because once you get up here, you're going to really like it. And, you know, it's cold. Okay. Well, in every gym in America, during the season, it's 70 and sunny, right? When I was at Florida Atlantic, we were 1.4 miles away from the beach. I never went to the beach and my players never went to the beach during the year. So it didn't really matter to me. So I think once we kind of convey that to some people, I think a lot of the image will change and we'll be able to really dive in and get more kids that are kind of what we're all about here in terms of building this thing.
Apparently it's not cold elsewhere in the Northeast. Is that what people are telling you?
Well, I was in UMass Amherst for 2 years and I almost got frostbite multiple times digging my car out. So
I believe it. It doesn't seem like the difference in temperature between Maine and a lot of the rest of the Northeast would be a whole lot different. It doesn't seem like that's a very solid pitch that I'd be trying to sell to recruits. When you guys are out on the road and you start recruiting, where's the main recruiting base for you guys? Where do you guys go to find players? And I guess then to go along with that, I'm not all that familiar with the high school basketball scene in the state of Maine. What's it look like as far as in-state players? And then where do you guys look outside the state for as your recruiting base?
Yeah. So the state of Maine is a very like serious basketball state. Their high school teams, I believe, only play between 18 and 20 games a year. So they don't play a lot of games. But if you go to any of these gyms around here, from everything that I've gathered, they're usually pretty packed. There's usually about one or two Division I players a year that come out of the state. So we're going to really spend a lot of time making sure we evaluate anyone that's got potential to play Division I in the state of Maine. Like that's going to be, you know, priority one, obviously, especially with Chris being one of the best players ever to play in the state and having that experience. But we're going to take the New England basketball scene. We're going to kind of make that a main focus for us. We're going to really do a lot of work in Canada. There's some pockets in Canada, Montreal, Ontario. There's a lot of different pockets in Canada that we feel that we can really dive into. So if you ask me right now, I'd say 1 and 1A is the New England prep school scene, is Canadian basketball, high school basketball. We're going to dabble in the international thing. You know, Maine's been able to do that and have some success. Coach Mark Wood's been able to do that. Coach Rob O'Driscoll, who's on our staff, has done a tremendous job of recruiting international kids at James Madison and Drexel. So we're going to dabble in that market as well. And then we've kind of taken an interesting approach where we're putting some pockets all over the country that we're going to really evaluate and see what comes. So we're going to look at some cold weather states. So we're going to look at Michigan, Wisconsin, Minnesota. We're going to focus in those areas. We've got a guy on our staff, Tommy Freeman, who played high school basketball in Indiana, who's really connected in Indiana. So we're going to focus a little bit on that pocket. And then we're going to focus on two major states in terms of Florida, an area that Chris and I have had a lot of experience recruiting, where there's a lot of guys that get under recruited and end up being good Division I players. And then we're going to take Texas and we're going to focus on that. So it's going to kind of be those four areas. Canada and New England's going to be one big one. The cold weather Midwestern states, right? Obviously, New Jersey, New York, and Philly has always got players. And then we're going to take the two big states of Texas and Florida and really just dive in there and try to evaluate. And then obviously nowadays with the transfer market, you got to really be heavy in it. But all that goes back to if you're really evaluating in the summer, you're going to have a really good pulse on who's going to different schools that you liked. So when those guys end up in the portal, you'll be able to make a quick strike on them and know what you're getting yourself into.
When you start looking at players, obviously there's a certain level of talent that a guy has to be able to have to play at the Division I level and to play at the University of Maine. But clearly when you're trying to build a program and talking about the vision that you guys have, there's more to it than just their talent. So when you start thinking about intangibles that you guys are looking for when you're out on the road recruiting or when you're watching film, what are some of the things that you're looking for from an intangible standpoint when you talk to a kid, when you talk to the people around them, when you watch them on film, when you see them in person? What are some of those things that you're looking for?
Yeah. So I kind of, we've kind of talked a lot about this as a staff in terms of like, what are guys that are going to be really good in college look like? But we kind of all talked with different players that we've had, you know, high upside, high character, right? Like low maintenance, high upside, low maintenance. If you're a high upside guy where you're not a finished product, whether you're young, you haven't played a lot of basketball, if you've got a lot of upside in your game, right, and you're low maintenance where you're a worker, you're a guy that wants to just come in, put in work, want to get coached, want to get better, those are normally the guys that overachieve in your program, right? So we're going to really look for guys that have a lot of upside, right, and they're not a lot of maintenance and just love basketball and want to get coached. Those are kind of two major points for us. Now, when it comes to the basketball thing, you know, obviously you got to love the game, right? That's kind of the ultimate separator. It's just your love for basketball. There's a lot of distractions out there now. So guys that really love basketball are going to move up on our board, right? And then from when it comes to playing the game, shooting and feel are two things that we're going to value a lot. You got to be able to shoot the ball. It's hard for you to get significantly better as a player if you don't have the upside of making shots. You know, the game at the end of the day, you got to put the ball through the net, right? And then feel for the game is something that's really hard to teach. That if you can get guys that have a high IQ for the game, that can process things, that can adjust to what type of game it is, then you're usually going to be able to function in college and be a good player at the collegiate level. So it's kind of a complex answer, but those are just kind of the things that we've talked about as a staff. That are really going to, they're really going to be important to us when it comes to making the decisions on who we really want to dive in there with.
When you're evaluating those things with a player, there's clearly two different environments where you get an opportunity to watch players. So you can watch them in an AAU environment, and then you can watch them with their high school team in that environment. When you guys are going out, whether it's you personally or you as a staff, if you've had these conversations, do you value one more than the other? Do you look for different things depending on which environment you're watching the player? And just how do you think about balancing or looking at a player in the AAU versus the high school environment?
That's a really good question. I actually think, you know, we'd all prefer to see as much structure as we can in the game, because then you can see how a kid can process the game, you know, how his feel for the game is. But then you can go watch some AAU programs that are absolutely terrific and run great stuff. And a kid might look a little bit less dynamic because he's really in structure. And then you can go to a high school program and watch a high school coach that just says, hey, we're going to run spread pick and roll all game and let our best player make plays. And, or it could be vice versa. So you don't know. So I think a lot of it depends on who your guy you're going to look at is playing for. And I honestly, Mike, I don't think you have enough time now to really try to say, okay, I like this kid, but I need to see him in high school. Like, I think you got to be able to make your decision off of watching, you know, summer basketball and really evaluating. If you had to ask me what, you know, the preference would be, I'd probably say I'd want to see a game, whether it's on an AAU circuit or a high school circuit, in a game that matters, like a win and go home game, or a big rivalry game. Or I like seeing guys when there's something on the line is kind of my biggest selling point. To if I'm on the fence about a kid and he plays really good in a big game, I know that he's got some moxie to him and he's going to be able to handle college.
That's a great point. I love that. I haven't really heard anybody say that, but when you think about it, makes a ton of sense, right? Because you want to be able to see a kid who's going to step up and handle that big moment, because hopefully what you're trying to build in a college program is that you're going to have some of those big moments. You want to know that you're going to have a kid that can step up and perform in that big, on that big stage. And if you can find a kid that can do that, then you're halfway there to getting them to be a part of your program and to have some success. Your first impression is everything when applying for a new coaching job. A professional coaching portfolio is the tool that highlights your coaching achievements and philosophies, and most of all, helps separate you and your abilities from the other applicants. The Coaching Portfolio Guide is an instructional membership-based website that helps you develop a personalized portfolio. Each section of the Portfolio Guide provides detailed instructions on how to organize your portfolio in a professional manner. The guide also provides sample documents for each section of your portfolio that you can copy, modify, and add to your personal portfolio. As a Hoopheads Pod listener, you can get your Coaching Portfolio Guide for just $25. Visit coachingportfolioguide.com/hoopheads to learn more. When you guys take over, obviously you're trying to recruit and build the roster and improve the roster, but you have some guys that were already there and some guys that I'm sure are going to be an important part of your team moving forward that are holdovers from the previous regime. So as you guys think about what you've done over the summer with the guys who have been a part of what you've done with your workouts, just tell us a little bit about kind of what the summer looks like for the guys that have been part of the roster that you're going to hopefully build your team around come this fall.
Yeah, so we've really tried to give everyone a blank sheet of paper and kind of just get a chance to know them and see how they work and see how they operate. And the biggest thing that we're just trying to do right now is we're just trying to build some trust. Like, I think whenever you take over a job or you just come into a job, you don't even necessarily need to take over a job as an assistant. Sometimes you come in and, you know, you're thrusted into a team that's ready to be really good. You just have to build trust with your guys, and trust is so many different ways. It's the consistency in how you approach every day. It's the consistency in how you are at practice. It's your consistency in checking in on them. It's your dialogue with them. So right now, the biggest thing that we're doing is we're just kind of building trust, and then we're kind of implementing our system, and we're allowing them to make some mistakes. And, you know, we always talk about how practice looks a little clunky right now. Well, it's going to look a little clunky when 13 players and 5 staff members have never been together before. So it's not going to look good. So I'm not saying that we're sitting over here and letting things go, but we're really just kind of being all in this thing together, trying to figure it out together and building trust together. And then we're going to kind of see how this thing moves getting closer to the season. But for right now, the biggest thing for us is just showing our guys that we care about them. We're here to develop them as players, here to develop them as people, and just kind of be invested into them. And then hopefully that'll parlay itself into some mutual two-way trust where the real growth and development can happen.
Tell us a little bit about what you're doing on the floor with the guys. How much time are you spending with them? And what do you guys hope to accomplish with the summer workouts? Obviously, you're tailoring them to each individual player and what you see their role going to be and all that kind of thing. But just tell us a little bit about the on-court workouts that you guys have had this summer and what those entail.
Yep. So, you know, majority of what we wanted to do when we got here was do a lot of individual player development, small group skill work, right? Because we felt like that would be a great way for them just to get better as players and for us to kind of them to get to hear our voices and know our voices. We quickly realized that we have a whole entire system that we have to implement. And this is where Coach Mark Wood, being so well thought out and really knowing himself and knowing what he wants the program to look like, he quickly stepped in and said, hey, we need to start implementing what we're going to do on both sides of the ball. And let's give our guys a really good base of everything throughout the summer. And once we give them that base, then we can go back and kind of go with a whole part whole method, right? So now when we come back in the fall, we can do a little bit more individuals and still build and implement. But we really spent the summer just installing our offense, parts of our offense, installing our base defense, how we're going to guard ball screens, how we're going to guard in our gaps, right? So we kind of implemented both our offensive shell and our defensive shell. And then we sprinkled in about 15 to 20 minutes per practice of skill development and combination shooting, which is essentially shooting out of our offense. And we felt like that was a good way to integrate us getting to coach these guys on their skill set and also implementing the brand of basketball that Coach Mark Wood's going to implement at the University of Maine. So we just got done, and we felt like we really covered what we had to get done in terms of giving them that shell. And now, you know, when we get back, it's going to be tightening up, building it back up. So we hit practice, we can really hit the ground running and really start getting this program to look the way we want it to look.
As you guys are meeting as a staff and Chris is going through and talking with you guys, how does he go about dividing up responsibilities among the staff? Is he an offensive coordinator, defensive coordinator, or is it everybody's coaching kind of everything? Are you responsible for a position group? Just how does he go about dividing up the responsibilities among the staff?
Yeah. So he was great with it. He said, "Hey, what do you guys want to take this?" You know, like I said, Jordan Bronner, your point guard, you've had a lot of success being a point guard at New Hampshire. Take the point guard. Rob O'Driscoll, you're a really good shooting coach. Let's get you really working with the wings. Pete, you've done a good job working with big guys at the places you've done. You take those guys. And then as far as kind of the overall part of what are we focused on, we're all kind of just figuring that out. But it's one of those things where, you know, where someone's going to be watching on the ball defense. Someone's going to be watching our protection, whatever happens behind the ball. Someone's going to be, you know, watching our offense. How's our offense spacing and our offensive execution? And we're going to kind of split that up as, you know, 5-on-5 starts happening more and it starts getting a little bit more fluid in practice. But it's just going to be something where we're all going to sit down and talk about it. It might be one day, hey, you got pick and roll defense, you got protection, you got offense, and we might flip it up just so we're pretty versatile in terms of what we're looking for. And then again, we all take ownership. Guys all hear our voices. Guys can go talk to anyone for film. And it just brings that whole cohesion that we believe here is what can separate, you know, a team, you know, is just how connected we all are, right? And if the staff is connected, the players are going to be connected. And the players can see if the staff is connected. And Coach Mark Wood comes from Coach Cohen, who seems like everything they do there is really connected. And Coach Mark was really stressing that we all have to be connected in what we do as a staff. And I just think that's going to really resonate with our players. They're going to feel comfortable. And then that's just going to lead them to be more connected with each other on the court.
That being said, tell us about the amount of time that you guys are spending together as a staff, meeting, going over things, especially here in the offseason. I'm not sure that, let's say if I'm a high school coach, I'm not sure that I know exactly what a college staff is doing on a day-to-day basis. As a high school coach, maybe I'm in the classroom and I can meet with my staff, but we don't all know kind of what goes on behind the scenes with the college staff. So as a brand new staff coming in, trying to turn around a program, and here you are in the summer months, what are your guys, what's the meeting schedule look like? How long do meetings last? What are you guys talking about? I know there's obviously lots of different things that you guys are talking about, but just give us an idea of how much time you're spending together in the coach's office, breaking down film, talking, and just trying to figure this thing out.
Yeah. Well, so no matter what, we're always going to meet on practice. And, it could be for an hour, it could be for an hour and 20 minutes. We're always going to meet and go over what we're going to do on practice, which, again, is one of the most refreshing things about working for coaches. He's so well thought out in terms of like what we're going to do and what everyone's going to be doing in practice. So we're always going to meet, right? That's going to take, you know, X amount of time every day. Like I said, it could be an hour, it could be 50 minutes, it could be 45 minutes, whatever. But the most interesting thing and one of the most refreshing things about being up here is we're always kind of around each other in the office. We're either sitting in the meeting room, we're sitting in my office, we're sitting in Rob's office, we're sitting in Tommy's office, we're sitting in Jordan's office. We're always just kind of around each other. So I couldn't put a clock to how long we are, how long we spend together, but it's pretty much all day. I mean, besides working out, we're either meeting on recruiting, we're meeting on what the program needs to get done, we're meeting on travel, we're meeting on gear, we're meeting on social media, we're meeting on how our locker room's going to look. Like, we're always just kind of meeting with each other. what the guys need. I mean, as you know, the players, sometimes they need to get a TV for their room. So we got to figure out how are they going to get there. They might need to figure out, hey, where's the – we have two new freshmen that just came last week. Where are they going to eat on campus? We got to show them where to go. So we're always around each other. So from when we get in to when we leave, besides maybe to go work out, we're generally around each other for that whole entire day.
It just shows up again, the amount of time that you have to put in order to get everybody on the same page and make sure that you're all rowing that boat in the same direction. And to get, as you said, build the trust amongst the coaching staff and then build that trust that the players can see it. And now you start to build the trust with your players. So as you guys think about building the relationships with your guys, what are some of the things that you do over the course of the summer to start to build that trust? You talked about, hey, we're showing up every day, we're doing this, and you know, the players are bought into the fact that they know we're here to make them better. But what are you doing to build the kinds of relationships that it really takes so that you can coach your guys and push them and get the most out of them?
Yeah, I just think being authentic. I think like that's just kind of who we are. Like we're all kind of, like we said in the beginning, we're all very thankful and grateful to be here. So I think when our guys see us being excited to be here and not feeling like a burden, you know, Coach Mark would always talk about coming to practice with a smile on your face. Like when you're coming every day with a smile on your face, when you're having like real authentic conversations with guys, you're asking them about their families, you're asking them about, you know, how they got here, you're diving into them a little bit more than, hey, I watched some tape on you and we need to work on this, that, and the third. Then they really start to feel like you're caring about them more than just what they can do on a court. So we're building it just by being authentic, right? So the best coaches I've worked for, the John Janinis, the Billy Donovans, you know, those guys are just the most authentic people that you're going to find. And then, you know, I've worked for other guys that are in it for the complete wrong reasons, and they're not authentic, you know? And I think that when guys see that and players see that and players feel that, you know, and one of the best things about Ashley Howard and Bashir Mason is like, you know what you're going to get with those guys every single day, because that's just who they are. Right. And Coach Mark Wood's the same way. So I think when it comes to building, you know, authentic relationships with guys and building trust, you just got to be who you are every day and really dive into them as kids. I think that that's how they're going to turn the corner on you and make sure that, you know, they trust you no matter what, when the bullets start flying come the season.
How does that dynamic work with you as an assistant? You can answer this, whether it's sort of where you are at the University of Maine or in some of your other stops. Obviously there's a slightly different relationship with an assistant coach as with a head coach. Ultimately the players know that the head coach is the guy who's going to determine whether or not they get on the floor. And so you have different assistants that sometimes fill different roles, that sort of, as you know, maybe a player confidant that a player can come to and talk about something that maybe they wouldn't bring to the head coach. So whether you want to address sort of where that is with, you know, at Maine, obviously you haven't gone through a season yet, so you haven't faced some of those playing time issues and some of the other things that as coaches can sometimes be challenging, but maybe in your other stops, just talk about how that relationship for you as an assistant coach was so important to the players that you coach, just because, again, the relationship with the head coach sometimes isn't always the same as it is for an assistant.
Yeah, I just think when you're an assistant coach, your messaging has got to be exactly what the head coach's messaging is. For now, sure. you can approach it a little different, right? But the one thing that you can never do is you can never give the guys any crutch that you're not aligned with the head coach. They're waiting for you to not be aligned with the head coach, right? So it doesn't matter how that comes across. You got to make sure that you're always completely aligned with the head coach. And that's kind of the way that the guys realize, like, hey, I can't get over. Like if I'm trying to tell people I'm getting screwed here and no one's believing me and no one's buying into it, then they got to really look in the mirror at themselves. Right. And that's, I think it goes back to this, Mike, at the end of the day, like your character as an assistant coach, right? Like your character as a man should be your same character as an assistant coach. If you're a loyal friend, right? You're a loyal husband, you're going to be loyal to your head coach, and you're going to kind of have his back. You're going to make sure that you're connected. You're going to make sure that you're in such good standing with your head coach and what he's thinking, that when a player comes to you about something, you can essentially rattle off what the head coach would say, and then we're all rowing in the same direction, and then there's no issues. And that's where constantly communicating is the best vitamin that you can give a program when you're a head coach or an assistant coach to your players. Just always communicating, so there's no margin for misinterpretation. And I think that's the most important thing you can do as an assistant coach, is just be overly communicating with your whole entire staff every day as much as you can.
That makes complete sense. And I think when you look at it, right, that consistent messaging and that idea that you can have those arguments right behind closed doors, you might have a disagreement or you might bring something to a head coach and the head coach thinks about it. You have that discussion in the coach's office. And then once everybody leaves the coach's office and that door closes, everybody's back on the same page. And I think as an assistant coach, that word that you hear over and over again that you use is loyalty, right? It's, there's a reason why somebody brought you on their staff to be a head coach. I've said this a couple of times, Pete, but it's one of the things that I think when I think about my coaching career, there's one statement that a guy that I was his assistant coach at the high school level for, I think we were together for 12 years. And after the fact, this is probably like 3 or 4 years ago. So he and I hadn't coached together for probably 10 years. And we were just having a conversation. He's like, Mike, the one thing that I appreciated about you more than probably anybody that I've ever had as one of my assistant coaches was the fact that I knew that I could count on you, that you were always going to be loyal to me and to our program. And you were never angling for trying to do something else or get another job or get my job. And there's, you know, you just never know when you bring people in, especially on the high school level, where sometimes you kind of inherit assistants or you get somebody who's a teacher in the district that maybe you don't have a relationship with or whatever. But that's probably one of the things that I'm the most proud of when it comes to my coaching career, is just that here's a guy I worked with and worked for a number of years. And, you know, the thing that he was most, you know, that made him feel the best about our relationship was the fact that, you know, I was loyal to him. And to me, just like you said, there's nothing as an assistant coach. If you don't have that, then you really don't have much of anything, because again, you want to be able to present that united front to the players. When you think about what you guys are trying to build there and you look ahead to the start of fall practice and you think about the season and you're going through it, and let's say it's next March, and at some point next March, unless you guys are cutting down the nets in April, well, then we can call it April. But what do you see as the definition of success in your first year? And obviously I'm not talking about wins and losses, but when you look back on the season, when it ends, what do you guys hope to say that, hey, this is how we're going to define success? Have you guys had that conversation?
Yeah. You know what? We haven't had that conversation, but I think that if we just focus on like keeping our culture tight, keeping the environment tight. And what I mean by that is keeping what Coach Mark Wood wants this program to look like, keeping that authentic every day, right? And we don't waver on that. So it's every single day we do that. The wins, you know, whatever other people define as success, that'll be their own. We'll know that we did our job if we keep everything moving in the right direction and we keep it tight throughout the whole entire year. You know, one of the best lines that I remember from Tom Crean when I worked at Indiana was, you know, climbing is easier than hanging on. He had this sign on his desk. It said, climbing is easier than hanging on. And I never really paid any attention to it. Like I was like, what is this? Like I was 21 years old, but it didn't make any sense. But I now, like being in it and seeing different programs and being on the start of programs and coming into other programs where you are hanging on, like if you're always climbing and you're always doing something and you're always making forward progress, it is so much better than just hanging on by a thread and catering and bending on what you want the program to look like. So for us, I think if we can just keep the program tight, keep our environment tight, and be authentic all year long and just be true to what coach wants this thing to look like, that's going to be success for us come March, no matter really what our record is. You know, the mentality of what we're trying to build is going to be there.
What are some things that you guys have looked at when you're sitting down in the film room and you're trying to evaluate what you have from last season? Are you guys mostly at this point, you're just looking at individual personnel? Are you looking at, hey, here's what this team did well last year, how can we incorporate that into this coming year's team? As you guys evaluate the film, what is it that you're looking for? What are some things that you found that you've seen that you think can help you heading into this season?
Yeah, so we've watched pretty much all of our guys that are returning and their shots, their turnovers, their fouls. We've watched a lot of that, and it's just pretty much like how they are as a player, you know, where we can tighten up their individual games, where they're comfortable on the court. You know, some guys didn't play a lot of minutes, but I think they really fit in our system really well. So, okay, what did they do well in their short minutes that we can really build off of? So it's been very player personnel based. And when we've watched film, now one of the things we are doing is we are looking at teams that we're going to play in the league and looking at their film and kind of what they've done in the past and just kind of getting a core sense of what the other teams in our league do. So now we can build into our, you know, our offensive solutions or our defensive adjustments to kind of what some other teams in the league do. So we've done a lot of that, but in terms of our team, it's just, it's been a lot more focused just on their personnel and what we can do to get them better.
Was there anything when you came in and as you've sat down and maybe initial impressions back when you guys first got the job and you were looking at players, any initial impressions that were maybe sort of off base after you had a chance to actually work with a guy out on the floor and actually dive into them a little bit more in the film room? Is there anybody that surprised you in, let's spin it positive, is there anybody that surprised you in a positive way that maybe on first glance you were like, I'm not sure about that guy. And now, as you've gotten a chance to work with them and you've seen what they're all about, that, and you can name names if you want or not name names, but just maybe talk about how the more you're around and the more familiarity you build with the guy, the more you sort of see what they're all about.
Yeah. So I'll just give this as a general thing. I think every single person in our program has surprised me because these guys were, I think, 6-26 last year, won 3 Division I games. So going into it, not knowing, I really didn't, I didn't know what to expect. I didn't know what I was walking into, but every one of these guys has completely impressed me with their coachability, their wanting to get better, their willingness to do whatever's asked of them. So I'm going to say every one of these guys has impressed me with that. It's all been better than I thought. And you know, basketball is one of these games, Mike, where it's really hard game to quantify. And, you know, there's so much analytics out there, but it's hard to look at basketball analytically because so much of it is driven by the environment that you're in on the court, who you're playing with, how the game's being played. You know, it's not like you're in baseball and you're going up there and you're going against the pitcher and you know what he's going to throw, or you know his 3 pitches he's going to throw at you. I mean, basketball is so unquantified. So I think they've all kind of impressed me in different ways, and I haven't tried to read into too much of what they didn't do last year as more of like, what can we get from them after working them out for a summer or a couple individuals, like what more they have to give than anything else.
When you're going through and you're doing this process with the players as a new staff, one of the things that we talk a lot with high school coaches about is the parents that are part of the program. So as a college program, and again, you can speak to what you guys are doing at the University of Maine, or maybe you can speak to what some of the other programs you've been with, just how you've engaged and maintained communication with parents and how important you feel that is in terms of making sure that you have the parents on board with what's going on in the program. Because I know in a high school level, obviously, it's really important. People are really dialed in. And I think about the way that parents are so involved with their kids' careers all the way from youth basketball up through high school and the amount of money that they're spending on trainers and travel for AAU and all these things. You have, I think, a different generation of players where the parents have been so much more involved in careers of players than they were 15 or 20 years ago. So just how have you guys handled that at Maine, or how have you handled that in the past with some of the other staffs you've worked with?
Yeah. So I have my best friend growing up is a head baseball coach. at a very prominent high school in New Jersey, and they're in the top 25 in USA Today. He's an unbelievable baseball coach. He worries about his parents all the time. It's almost to the point when he calls me, it's like, he's not even worried about the game. He's worried about the parents, right?
Yep.
And I, every time he says that, I just think I never want to be in that position ever. I don't want to be in it. Now, every single coach I've worked for is different in terms of how they've handled parents, right? I think that the common denominator in college is a majority of the time in recruiting, you've got to get to know the parents, and you can choose if you want that parent in your program or not in recruiting, right? And I think that there's some parents that are so overbearing and so much that there's some coaches that say, I don't want that in my program. I don't like where that's going to lead. When you inherit a team, it's a little different because you're kind of stuck with those kids and their parents. And I think that the one thing that you can always do is just be really transparent in your conversations with them, kind of see where they're at, and just, again, not cater to things that aren't about the team, right? And I've had some coaches that say, I'm not talking to any parents. I've had some coaches that literally take parents' phone calls after games. So it's so all over the place that it's hard for me to give you an answer on that. But I'll say this, like, your parents are always going to have a vision of you as a player that is completely different and than what the head coach is going to view you as. It's just, it's never going to completely align, and it shouldn't. I mean, that's your child. So I think the one thing that you can do whenever you're an assistant coach, is you can just show those parents that your loyalty is to the program and to the head coach. And I think if you do that and don't waver, and again, it's very similar to what you talk about with the players. Like, if you don't waver, you don't bend on that, they can't throw anything at you because it's not coming back at them, right? So if you establish those lines early in the relationship with the parents, a lot of that stuff just becomes white noise, and, you know, and goes back on them because no one's drinking the juice that they're trying to make you drink. So I hope that answers your question a little bit. Again, it's so different in every place that I've been, but, you know, for me, the one thing that I think really benefits college is you can get to know parents in the recruiting process and then usually make a decision if you want that crew around as you're going through trying to win some games and have some difficult times.
Yeah, that's a great point. I think the ability to sort of pre-screen not just the player, but pre-screen the parents makes a big difference. And you know at least a little bit of what you're getting into before you get into it. And as we know, I mean, parents obviously have a big influence on their kids, and rightfully so. And yet at the same time, I know that as coaches, one of the things that no matter what level you talk to coaches at, they want to be able to have that impact on their players, and they want to make sure that the players understand what it's all about, that it's about team. And I think parents sometimes, and again, we can completely understand why, you and I are both parents and you love your kids, and sometimes you're not always realistic about what it is that your kids are or aren't. And parents can sometimes, unfortunately, get a little bit crazy. So as you said, the fact that you can pre-screen them out through the recruiting process, I'm sure makes a big difference at the college level compared to the high school level, where you kind of get what you get and you got to figure it out. And as you said, your friend who coaches a baseball team, man, you got to spend a lot of time on parents as a high school coach. Let's put it that way.
Yeah. And it's a time period in their life too. Like, that high school experience is just, it's delicate. You know what I mean? And it's a hard thing to really navigate. And I feel bad for all the high school coaches that got to deal with that. And I also know that, you know, one of the worst things as a parent is seeing your kid unhappy or seeing your kid suffer. And that's a really hard part as a parent. So there's always kind of that clash. And I feel really bad for you guys that you got to do that all the time.
I think what's interesting, and, you know, as a parent, so I have a son who's a high school junior this year, and my daughter's going to go to college here in the next week or so. And she doesn't play. She's just going as a regular student. But it's interesting, just as a parent, you realize like how fast these 4 years of high school go. And as a college player, how fast those 4 years go when you're sitting there as a parent and you just realize that, man, it goes quick and then it's gone. Whereas sometimes I think as coaches, we sometimes forget that the player's experience is so short because we as coaches have the ability to have a long career. And so you say, okay, we got this year and then next year. And then, and you know, you're getting a new crop of guys in, you're recruiting them. And that's not to say that you're looking at them as numbers that you're just bringing through the program. I completely understand and get that that's not the case. But I guess my point is, as a parent, you realize that those experiences go super fast. And sometimes as a coach, you get caught up kind of in such of the minutia that you don't realize it quite as much. It's like, I always was amazed that as a player, one time I ran into my high school assistant coach. This was years and years after I graduated. And we were talking. He's like, now I'm trying to remember, you know, who was on your team. And he named a couple guys who were like, seriously, like 7 years older than me. And I'm like, yeah, I didn't play with those guys. But kind of as a coach, you know, it's sort of at some point it kind of run, you know, that stuff kind of runs together. And it's just interesting how the perspective, your perspective as a parent is different from my perspective when I was a coach. It's totally different kind of in the way you look at it and approach it. And I think that sometimes, no matter which side of it are on, sometimes as a parent, you forget what the coach is going through. And sometimes as a coach, you forget what the parents are going through, if that makes any sense.
No doubt. I live by this thing. I heard this old Italian guy say this once. It's, you know, make every day long. And I was like, why would you want to do that? Like, why would you want every day to be long? And I think about it now all the time with these guys in college. Like, yeah. I want to make every day long for them. I want to make every day fun for them. I want to max out every day with them, because like you're saying, I mean, 4 years goes by so fast. And then all of a sudden, you know, they're out of college and you just had them and you're like, damn, where did that go? So I always think about that. Just like kind of make every day long and just kind of spin that into your own way of just trying to get the most out of everyone every day and not taking the day for granted.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. I mean, I think if you can maximize the experience that you get, right? I mean, honestly, that's really when you start talking about building a new program like you guys are doing, what you're talking about is, A, obviously you want to have success on the floor. Your win-loss record at the Division I level is important. And yet at the same time, I think what I hear you saying right there is that not only do you want to win on the court, but you also want to create the type of experience that your players are going to enjoy and that they're going to look back on fondly. And if you can build that type of program, that's going to make the recruiting process so much easier, because now guys are going to come in, they're going to talk to your current players are going to say, man, this is a place that you want to come and play because this staff cares about you, because the experience of playing here is such a good one. And then that sort of starts to feed on itself, right? That's when you know you have success. Then when your staff, it's not just your staff selling the program, but your players are buying in and they're the guys enforcing the culture. And I would guess that that's where you guys eventually want to get to.
Yeah, no doubt, man. It's all environment, man. It's all, the kids can feel it from a mile away when they're around your players and they're around the staff and they feel it, then you know you're doing something right.
So to go along with that, I think one of the challenges that coaches face is, how do you keep the guys at the back end of your roster? So the guys who are your players, who are your reserves, how do you make sure that you keep them engaged and buying in and a part of what you're doing? Because obviously the guys who are out on the floor, it's easy for them to feel connected to the program. It's easy for them to feel good about the coaching staff. It's harder for guy 13 who, look, every guy on a college roster, I'm sure, thinks they should be playing. So guy 13 who's playing 2 minutes a game in blowouts, how do you make sure that you keep that kid engaged? What are some of the things that you've done in the past, or that you've seen head coaches do in the past, or that you guys have talked about there at Maine, that you can do to keep those guys who maybe aren't getting the minutes they want? How do you keep them on board and on task with what you're trying to do?
Yeah. So I'm going to give a lot of credit to Ash Howard on this, because, you know, when I was at LaSalle, Ash would always talk about this, and he got it from Jay Wright. And it's just, you know, it's roles are different, status is the same. You know, it's a big Jay Wright thing. And we talked about it a lot at LaSalle. And it's just making sure that everyone feels very important, you know, in their role, regardless of their role. And then, you know, really taking those guys that aren't playing and developing a program for them where they're constantly feeling like they're getting better, even if they're not on the court, right? So everyone's always going to be getting better when they're on the court. That's the number one way to really get better as a player. That's why the G League was created, right? But in college, we don't have the luxury of sending guys down to play in the G League, right? So we have to be really creative with the guys that aren't playing in terms of their player development to make them feel like they're getting better, right? And part of the player development is more than just the on-the-court instruction. It's the authentic dialogue that we have with them to keep them aligned with the ultimate goal, which is winning, being a good teammate, serving each other, enjoying other people's success, right? And if we have that dialogue going with them and we're teaching them that as they're not playing, it's going to make that experience better for them. Some guys, regardless of what you do, are not going to want to come back, and they're going to want a different role. But as long as their status is all kind of the same, their role can be different and they're still going to be getting better. So, you know, Ash was amazing at that. I love him as a person for everything that he did for me. And he did a really good job at LaSalle. And, you know, it didn't really come to fruition. But if you look at what he was able to do with guys in terms of developing them, he really made us as a staff focus on that. So I'd love to bring that wherever I go. I think that's a really important thing. And I think that no matter where you are, if you have that relationship with your guys and you're constantly working with them to get them better, then they're going to eventually, it's going to crack if they're bought in and they're going to have success the way that they want to have success.
That makes sense.
You know, so, and then here's another thing too. You know, Villanova did this thing called flush days that I thought were brilliant. So the day after a game, they would do kind of a flush lift. They'd go over some plays, and then the guys that didn't play would get like a really hard individual, maybe one-on-one, two-on-two. And it was just a way to keep those guys really, really engaged on the day after game. So all that bad energy could just kind of flush itself out through the process of lifting, preparing, and individual instruction.
That makes a lot of sense. I mean, I think that anything that you can do to make sure that those guys are bought in. Another thing that now I'm trying to remember who told me this, but just recently on one of our shows. And so forgive me for whoever shared this with me, but talked about how as the head coach, like going out and rebounding for your guys that don't play, you know, like, hey man, I'm going to, you know, let's go through a workout. And it's not the assistant coach. It's not the graduate assistant. It's the head coach that comes out and says, hey, let's do a shooting workout. Let me rebound for you. And obviously when you're rebounding and when you're going through that individual workout, you're having a conversation with the kid. And what better way to show that you're valuing that player who's maybe not playing a lot, not getting a lot of minutes and not contributing as much as they want to do on the floor, but you're spending time and taking that time just individually with them to be able to go through and do that. I thought that was something that I hadn't heard anybody say before, but to me, that seems like a really powerful thing that a head coach could do.
Yeah. So I'll hit you with a quick Coach Donovan story. So I'm at Florida the year after the Final Four, and we're struggling, and we finished 500 that year. And it's like February on like a Sunday. I think we lost on a Saturday, maybe to LSU at LSU, got blown out. And we come back on a Sunday, and I go into the office early. And, you know, some of the guys come down on the court to work out. It was an injured guy. It was a red shirt and it was a walk on. And he put him through like a 45 minute, like really hard individual. And I'm like, this guy's a Hall of Fame, 2-time national championship coach. And he's down there with three guys that can't come in and play on the next game. And he's working them out and getting them better. And like, that was to me, when I saw that, I was like, wow, like this, there's a reason why this guy's going to be in the Hall of Fame. And I kind of asked around and they're like, yeah, he does that all the time. Like he's always invested in those guys, even if they're not playing, just kind of showing them that he's there for them and coaching them up. And I think that goes such a long way.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't think there's any doubt. There's no way that if you're a guy at the back end of the roster and your head coach is coming down and pouring into you, look, everybody's competitive and you still, you still aren't happy that you're not getting on the floor. But the idea that somebody in the coaching staff, especially the head coach, is still investing in you and putting time in and trying to get you better and help you improve so that eventually you can get out on the floor and contribute. I can't see where there'd be anything any more valuable than that. When you look ahead, what are you excited about for this season? When the season starts, what part of it are you most excited for?
I'm excited to see, I'm excited to watch our guys in a completely new environment, completely new system. I'm excited to watch them kind of figure it out. You know what I mean? Like, I think, you know, they're going to get baptized by fire. You know, we're playing Nebraska in the first game of the year, and I think Boston College, our third game of the year. Like, we're going to get really tested. So I'm excited to just see our guys figure it out. I'm excited to see how they respond to when it's not going well. I think, like, when it's not going well in year one, so much character comes out, right? And you have a chance to really coach guys on character in this first year. You know, you only get year one once. So I'm really excited to see how we're going to respond to all things good and bad, and just see how these guys are and when the bullets are flying, and be there to kind of help them through it.
Two questions to wrap things up. Actually, it's a one question, two-parter. So first part, when you look ahead over the next year or two, for you personally, what do you see as the biggest challenge ahead in the next year or two? And then part two, what's the biggest joy that you get out of what you get to do every day, waking up and being an assistant there at the University of Maine? So your biggest challenge and your biggest joy.
Biggest challenge, I think, is just going to be kind of changing the perception, just kind of changing, like, you know, when people think, you know, why can't you win or whatever. I just think that's always going to be a challenge, just changing people's perception. You know, I don't really put a lot of thought into what others think, but I think that there is some truth in the fact that you're going to have to change a narrative whenever you come to a job where they haven't won in quite some time. But the one thing about Chris is he's been here when they've won. So he knows what it looks like. So I think that's going to be the biggest challenge. The biggest joy in doing what I do, honestly, to me, the biggest joy is that when I come home, I'm in a good mood. Like, I think there's a lot of guys that I know that they don't like their job or they don't like the people they work with, and they kind of bring that into the home, and it kind of resonates with their family in the wrong way. And I'm glad that I can come home every day, be in a good place, give myself to my family when I come through the door, and kind of know that I'm going to wake up tomorrow and do something that I like. So the biggest joy to me is being able to do what I like and then be able to come home and be in a good mood and not, you know, bring any bad energy into the house.
That's invaluable. Not many people, not everybody gets a chance to do that. And I've said this numerous times on the pod and a lot of times in response to how guys answer that question. But to me, I think that, you know, what I hear you saying and what other coaches I think try to express is the fact that, you know, you get to be with basketball every day. You get to do something that you love, and you get to use that thing that you love to be able to have an impact on the kids that you coach. And then you can obviously bring that home in a positive way and be able to interact with your family and be happy. And not everybody, like I said, not everybody has an opportunity to do something that they love and have an impact on the world and do it with a game that, just like it's been so good to me, I know it's been good to you. And I think that, you know, you could feel, as you're talking tonight, I can feel the passion that you have for coaching and what you're trying to do and what you guys are building at the University of Maine. And it'll be exciting to be able to watch and kind of track your progress and see how you guys go through and what the season looks like. And, you know, as we talked about a little bit earlier, when you get done with this year and you look back and you try to define what success looks like, you know, I think you guys are going to get that thing going and get it built the way that you want to get it built. Before we wrap up, I want to give you a chance to share how people can find out more about what you guys are doing there at the University of Maine. You can share a website, social media, email, how people can reach out to you. And then after you do that, I'll jump back in, Pete, and wrap things up.
I don't even know what my Twitter handle is. I don't know, but
we're gonna put that in the show notes, and I'm probably gonna find it right here before you find it.
There you go. And then just Google Maine basketball, you know, hopefully you'll hear about us because we're playing well and we're winning games and we're doing the right thing. And that's kind of if you really love ball and you're really into it, you'll find guys you want to study and learn from and follow and root for. So hopefully that'll be what it is.
There it is. At Coach Pete Gash. That's you, man.
There you go.
Twitter. And the program's Twitter is at MaineMBB. So if you want to follow Pete, you want to follow Maine basketball, that's where you want to go. Again, Pete, I cannot thank you enough for taking the time out of your schedule to jump on with us. It's been fun learning more about you and your journey and then the type of program that you and Chris are trying to build up there at the University of Maine. We're looking forward to being able to follow you guys this year and see where success takes you. So again, thank you. And to everyone out there, thanks for listening, and we will catch you on our next episode. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to the Hoopheads podcast, presented by Head Start Basketball.